worldwide, actually. When you consider a world where we can do a radio program from Southeast Asia, the other side of the world, that literally goes around the world, we're already at a pretty wild point. But in context with tonight's subject and nanotechnology, we're talking now about things like supercaps. Somebody suggests that we could do a whole show on supercaps. We probably could. They're really here right now. It is an amazing world we live in, no question about it. Sir Charles Schulz III back in a moment to tell us more about it. At home, or that is to say in the U.S., when I would get an electric bill, the electric bill would just, it would give you whatever the charge is for the current month. Here in the Philippines, they do it a little differently, and they actually break down for you each part of your electric bill. And part of that electric bill is the actual transmission loss charge. And the amount of transmission loss is astounding. I don't have one in front of me. My wife was here. She's at the market right now. But if she was here, I'd bring one in and read it to you. But the transmission loss charge is quite significant. Sir Charles, would that be changed to a great degree if nanotechnology got involved in the transmission of electricity?
Well, I certainly expect so. Right now, they're already doing experiments with materials that are made of the nanofibers, the carbon nanotubes, that show them to have conductivities that are equal to metals at this point. And this means that they're very close to bringing them into production as a wire. To give you an example of some of the properties they have, just very odd things. You know, the best conductor of heat known, for instance, was diamond. This stuff is twice as good, but it has a very odd property. If you feel the ends of it, it feels cold like metal, but if you feel the sides, it feels like wood, because it conducts heat better in one direction than the other.
Wow.
And it also is a very good electrical conductor, because the electrons move through it ballistically, like little bullets, instead of being swerved back and forth as they conduct. And so it's quite possible that with a little more nanotech, we could have lossless conduction, like a superconductor, using carbon as the bulk of the material. So they're very close to having some very new, very odd materials made out of nothing but carbon.
Oh, my God. Stacy from Frederick, Maryland, this one is made for you, Sir Charles, says, hey, could we use nanotechnology to perhaps terraform another planet? Well, like Mars, using their replication to copy DNA from Earth and start vegetation and a nitrogen cycle on Mars.
Absolutely. In fact, nanotechnology has some amazing possibilities for space exploration and colonization. I'll give you an example. Suppose we have nanomachines about the size of dust particles that have whole factories programmed into them, the ability to produce everything you need, metals, plastics, food. And we launch these particles, like dust, out of a linear accelerator near the speed of light. They could scatter to all the planets and stars in a very short period of time, and when they arrived, just like a spore, they would begin to grow. You would end up with whole factories and colonies out of nothing more than something as small as a dust particle.
That's like the Genesis bomb from Star Trek.
Exactly. You see, this is one of the things that has, it's like a two-edged sword. If you use that sort of an effect, not only could you destroy a world, but you could also reconstruct it, and there'd be no trace of what you had done. You would effectively have erased and started over.
That's kind of godlike, actually.
Well, yes, it is. Yes, it is indeed. And as you can understand, there is going to be a lot of yelling about those possibilities when general nanoassembly becomes available. Now, of course, on the other side, we have to admit that the gray goo syndrome we spoke about earlier is less likely, because the types of control it would take to produce a scenario of that sort means you're probably going to have a manufacturing cell that has certain strict laws imposed on it or rules.
Mm-hmm. Well, speaking of that, I guess nanotechnological research is going on within government and in universities, and who knows, perhaps labs that we don't know about right now. What kind of oversight I mean, we've discussed a little bit of the upside and certainly the downside of this. What kind of oversight is in place right now for those doing this work?
There really aren't any laws involved because nanotech itself really doesn't, it isn't a recognized entity at this point, not really. There's been no sort of law or oversight put in place to control what would happen. And at this point, you couldn't really know if what you were leading to would be a weapon or something very dangerous or something very beneficial. So there is none.
Well, what do you suggest?
I wouldn't even have the faintest idea where to begin because the complexity of the question is so immense. I think that an oversight would be very difficult. It would mean having somebody review what you were doing on a daily basis and backing everything up. But you run into the same problem with any company developing something. The people who are doing the overseeing typically don't understand what's happening. Only the researchers do.
Exactly.
So the heart of the matter is, what's being developed is something nobody knows about yet. The researcher has that moment of glory where he discovers something new and nobody else knows it, and he'd be hard pressed to explain it, perhaps.
That sounds awfully dangerous to me. I mean, it when you're talking about, for example, gray goo or something that could accidentally become gray goo, all it takes is one oops. And, boy, that'd be some oops.
Well, fortunately, we can follow some of the same parameters we do for antivirus software in computers. Because we have people actively developing viruses for computers all the time, there's a big antivirus industry. And so we've learned a lot of things from that that might have direct applications to nanotechnology. And, of course, in the beginning, it's going to be very hard for someone to develop something that is, intentionally dangerous out of nanotech. And if we were to have a world where nanotech is common, we would expect that there would be some generally released anti-nanotech cells in the atmosphere or all around everywhere that patrolled and watched out for what was happening and might circumvent problems.
Okay, well, I can imagine gray goo being like a forest fire, for example. And I let me begin by asking, if gray goo were released and it was efficient, how fast would it be? How quickly would it begin virtually eating everything in front of it up?
I think that you would probably not be able to see it happen because of the energy constraints. It takes a certain amount of energy to transform things from one form to another. Mm-hmm. I would say that it would probably take something on the order of days or weeks to spread all over the world, not a matter of hours or minutes. But even at that, that's very little time to do something about it.
That's right. And so my next question would be, we fight a forest fire sometimes with fire breaks. Occasionally we will start a backfire to stop a fire, or there are various methods, dump retardant and all the rest of it. But if a gray goo fire started, how can you imagine that we might stop it?
Well, actually, there is a method of doing it. X-ray lasers, X-ray radiation in dense bursts can stop nanotechnology because it will disrupt the operation of it. It will destroy it internally, just as it does biological organisms. So it could very well be that large X-ray guns would be the tool of choice for stopping a nano escape of that sort.
Nanotechnological advances in the area of medicine may eventually lead to immortality. In other words, I guess it might. It might allow us to either fix and or replace virtually everything within our body, including our brains, and that would be a kind of immortality, wouldn't it?
Yes, it would. If we could have full control over what happens at the atomic level, we'd have the ability to repair any damage, regrow a lost limb, or recover from any sort of an illness very, very rapidly. So it could effectively allow us to reverse the aging process and live technically forever.
That's almost hard to imagine, to live forever. I wonder, have you given that much thought, whether that would be actually a good thing? Whether, I suppose, given that final choice, just about everybody would want to go on living, I guess.
Well, there would be a price, and I think it would be we would have to build in limits so that people could not reproduce. Because one of our problems we have right now is population growth versus the resources that are available.
We
I think
sure
that
do.
If anybody agreed, you know, to, if anybody wanted to take the nanotechnological treatment and effectively become immortal, they would have to agree to become sterile. And that would limit the growth of the population so we didn't overrun the planet in just a few short years.
Uh-huh.
Because there actually, you know, there can be real downsides to being immortal. And believe it or not, that can be abused. I mean, imagine if you were in fact immortal and could recover from any sort of damage, effectively resurrecting if you were killed, and then how would you go about using that in a terrible way? Well, I can think of a very simple way. You torture someone to death, and then they resurrect, and you do it again. So in that case, you really wouldn't want to live forever. You could actually abuse the ability to be immortal.
God. This brings up so many possibilities that I've never even considered. That's certainly one of them, being tortured to death and then brought back and tortured to death yet again. It's incredible. Where do we go from where we are right now? I mean, already there are applications, as you mentioned earlier, that are in the real world. I've heard about paint, for example, nanotechnological paint that I think is being produced up in Canada. You can paint a house and then it begins producing electricity. Is that still going on?
Yes, it is. By using short lengths of fibers that are tuned to specific frequencies of light, it can produce electricity from sunlight. So you can effectively paint this on a surface and it becomes a solar cell. It's got a very good efficiency. That's one of the very positive results of nanotech research. Another one would be the development of materials such as liquid metals. You've seen the Terminator movies where they have the liquid metal Terminator. Well, we can actually make a substance that acts like the liquid metal, and it consists of trillions of tiny robots, smaller than dust particles, and they have grabbers all over their surfaces, and they can grab their neighbors in different positions and change their shape. So it becomes like a technical sort of clay, and it can be commanded to take on any shape and then harden. It can change its surface texture and color on command, and it could be used actually to camouflage a machine if you had to. This is a real possibility, and they're already working on smart materials that are made in little modules, and nanotech will give us the ability to make these things that are microscopic. So it would look like a liquid metal, yes. Another thing is, and this is a downside, growing everything using nanotechnology would wreck the economy. You wouldn't need machine shops anymore because your parts could be fabricated very easily. I mean, think of the Star Trek replicator, but instead of using energy fields as they do in the fiction, you would use nanoparticles to grow everything. You'd have a manufacturing cell that basically was a Santa Claus machine. You ordered what you wanted.
Well, okay, so in that kind of economy, Sir Charles, who makes the money?
And that's the whole point. There wouldn't be any specific person making the money once this technology was mature. It would be out there, and you could manufacture literally anything you wanted just by asking for it. And so it shuts down all your industry, basically, because nanotech can be self-perpetuating. Yes, there'd be upgrades and changes for a while, but after a bit, you'd reach a point where everybody felt that it was mature and that was stable in the end of it, and everything could be grown from sunlight and raw elements.
My God. In other words, there essentially would be no economy.
That's right. Everything would be free. And I'm not sure what sort of a society that would make.
I'm not
it
sure
would be
either.
The ultimate welfare trip.
That's right. And of course, a lot of people have talked about the nanotubes that are now reality becoming this space elevator. Now, I just finished talking to Bob Bigelow, who's launched his first private sector spacecraft, and I know there are plans on the table for this space elevator made of nanotubes that would allow us to literally take an elevator into space. Is that idea now dead, still on the table, underway? What's going on?
Actually, it's still under development, and there's even one company called Liftport that is making hardware that will allow them to test out some of the systems that will be necessary for a space elevator. They have a balloon system with a cable that can be climbed by something that is effectively just like the climber on a space elevator that can carry hardware for communications, and they're even working on contracts to do wireless internet service. So they'll be using their systems to do research on the space elevator hardware, at the same time making money by selling wireless internet systems where you don't have satellites. So they'll
Wait a minute. I cannot picture this in my mind. Describe to me how the wireless internet aspect of this would work.
You put a balloon with a very high tensile strength cable anchored to the ground up into the atmosphere. And then you put a cable climber on that cable. And this cable climber is the same design as you would use on a space elevator. And it carries your wireless internet communication links up to whatever altitude you need and provides your wireless service to a nearby city.
Wow.
So it's a tethered balloon with a cable climber on it and communications hardware. And the nanotubes themselves are making a lot, you know, they're making a lot of progress in making the material in bulk. Now, recently there was a critique that said, well, the machines making these don't make them perfectly, and a flaw here and there, a missing carbon atom in places here and there, would cause the material not to be strong enough. But I think that this can actually be overcome. Just like we anneal metals to change their properties and harden them, I think we're going to find an annealing process that will allow us to repair damaged nanotubes, and, you know, the manufacturer will go on. I don't really see any showstoppers to the space elevator.
Uh-huh. That would, of course, this would change, nanotechnology would change virtually everything. It would replace our economy. It would, it would turn it into sort of it would be dangerous, Sir Charles. There are people who would probably go to great lengths to stop any such progress, wouldn't they?
Well, yes, I can imagine a lot of things that we do today that would have direct applications to it. For instance, imagine a medication that you have to pay a subscription for it to work. You know, there will be stumbling blocks put in the way. They'll try to regulate it using your money. And I think that that's going to be one of the things that will slow the development to a crawl in many places.
You know, what about patents, for example?
Well, you know, patents... I sometimes take issue with patents because they seem to be rather ineffective these days. Patenting nano hardware is just fine, but what happens to the intellectual property rights when you need a template to grow, parts for a machine using your new nano factory that sits in a shoebox on the table? You're going to end up having a lot of patents issued in the beginning when everything becomes the new tech and everything's being sold to everybody and there's money being made. But later on, when you have a nano factory in your home that makes what you need, well, who are you going to pay for the templates for the things you're going to make?
Right.
And so there is a big intellectual property issue involved there, because what everything comes down to in the end is a template. I mean, anything you can think of, anything you own, anything you have, and anything you see can be described mathematically and chemically and physically. And you can somehow get it on a computer disk or in a program somewhere. And then later, if you had that information, you could call it up and manufacture a duplicate of it. I got to point this out. When nanotechnology becomes common, forgery becomes useless. You can't tell the original from a copy because it can be made so perfectly, atom for atom, it would be indistinguishable.
So it's kind of like the new digital world. I mean, right now the movie industry is deeply in fear of this new digital world that we're entering now, where you can, for example, duplicate a motion picture with absolutely no degradation whatsoever. Yeah, so you're talking about the material world, just as I'm talking about duplicating motion pictures with no degradation. Same deal, right?
Well, that's absolutely correct. What the end result would be was a system that would allow you to absolutely duplicate or create anything with no loss. And the world itself then becomes just as fluid as a computer game. Our reality will shift right around us.
Our reality will shift, in a good way to put it. So really, science fiction does have it nailed, because in the end, anything that we can imagine, we can do.
That's right. We're only limited by the laws of physics and the availability of materials and energy. Now, you know, some of the things that will come along, I think, in the near term, and this might be a positive thing, everybody has seen movies where people become miniaturized and travel through a world of cells and giant monster bugs and that sort of thing.
Right.
We can actually create small robots right now, and you can use a VR experience to move the robots around and run around in a maze or something. But what happens when you make nano robots, small as cells, and you put on the VR headset, and you run them around the tabletop or in an aquarium or whatever. You can tour on the microscopic level without actually being miniaturized.
Oh, my God. All right. We're at another break point. Hold on, Sir Charles. Sir Charles Schultz III is my guest. And, you know, we've laid out so much material right now that what I'd like to do is open the phone lines when we come back at the after the break here, and allow all of you to begin asking some questions. I mean, the world that Sir Charles describes is so astounding and so different and potentially so destructive to the world that we all know right now that I don't know. I don't know where we're going. Maybe some of you have relevant questions. From Manila, the Philippines, I'm Art Bell. Indeed. Coming to you from a land where satellite dishes point straight up because we're just about at the equator. It's really amazing. Actually, they have to drill little holes in the middle of the satellite dishes so the rain that pours so freely down here can drain away. Anyway, that's where we are. My guest is Sir Charles Schultz III, describing a world that is almost unimaginable. And you think it's not possible? Well, an awful lot of the applications we've been talking about tonight are underway and being produced right now, or about to be produced. What a world it's going to be. We'll give you a chance to talk with Sir Charles and ask any question, because anything you can imagine is probably possible in a moment. Interesting. Listen to this. With respect to nanotechnology, Chuck from Nevada says, remember Arthur C. Clarke's famous line from Childhood's End, the technology of a truly advanced civilization is indistinguishable from magic, and that certainly seems to apply to nanotechnology. Sir Charles?
Yes, I would have to agree with that. We can do literally anything with nanotechnology.
All right.
And it's coming. It's coming.
Just before we go to the lines here, and there's a million people who want to talk to you, I do want to ask this. Years ago, science fiction talked a whole lot about robots. I mean, we were going to have robots walking around doing the vacuum, vacuuming, doing dishes, doing all of our drudgery work. It was all going to be a done deal some years ago. Well, it never happened. Now, what is the promise of nanotechnology a more solid promise than that of robots was?
Well, it probably is in the fact that we're going to see a lot of applications right away, and the first ones we're going to be seeing will be medications and displays, display technologies and high tensile strength materials. But you see, the problem with robotics is we don't see intelligent robots because people are having a hard time working out the software for them, and it's all a matter of organizing the software. The nanotech is going to pay off a lot more quickly, I think, because there's a great deal of development going on. And one of the things we're going to see is nanotechnology is going to allow us to engineer materials that are indistinguishable from living materials. You can have a robot that looks so human, it would be indistinguishable. And you're going to see that. You're going to see that as soon as the nanotech becomes available and the material science advances a little bit more.
All right. One other question before the phones, and that is, we're all seeing a warming world right now. I think there's very little disagreement left. Global warming is well underway. Whatever's causing it is causing it, but it is underway. It's going to change the way we live. It's going to change agriculture. It's going to change just about everything. The storms are getting more violent. We all know what's going on. I'm wondering if there's any potential application for nanotechnology in terms of controlling the weather.
Well, it certainly could be. We could have particles in the atmosphere that were black on one face and silver on the other that could be rotated under command to reflect sunlight away during the day and retain it when we wanted it. And so we could turn the particles over from black to reflective and change the amount of sunlight reaching the surface of the planet. That could be done with nanomachines. But there's other ways to do it, too. I mean, I've got a solution for ending global warming right now that we could do in a matter of days, and it would be very, you know, non-politically correct and controversial, but it would certainly work.
We take our
three biggest hydrogen bombs, go out to the rottenest piece of desert we have, and we detonate them. And we introduce a small amount of nuclear autumn. And every 5-6 years, we reevaluate and do it again as needed. And the downsides that people mention, like fallout, don't apply because, you know, we're very conscientious weapons makers, and we don't want to make bombs that are going to make a territory radioactive. We couldn't occupy it or go in and take care of business. So the weapons that we make tend to burn out their fallout within a few days. And this would be a solution that, you know, don't hide it. Tell everybody, bring your cameras, come see the show. You know, we're going to end global warming now. But the only reason that this will not happen is because there's no way for anybody to make a buck off of it. And I can guarantee you that the one thing slowing down any progress in global warming is nobody's figured out how to make a dollar off of it.
And, well, how about the Arizona desert? Everybody always wants to go for Nevada. And
well, that's right. We have a nuclear test site. You know, we have a number of nuclear test sites in the desert. It would be ideal. So
I know.
The facilities are already in place. This could be done very, very easily.
All right. Wildcard Line, you're on the air with Sir Charles Schultz III.
Are you talking to me?
I am indeed.
Oh, this is Ronnie. I'm from Pennsylvania.
Yes.
And hi, everybody. Sir Charles, you made my mind spin. I have a degree in biology, and in the 70s, I wrote a book. I didn't publish this book. I studied cells upon cells. I took every biology course I could find. I told my son, I said, Michael, I said, everything is made of molecules. I said, compressed molecules and atoms. I said, in one day, people are going to be thinking more on the atomic, the little atom. And I said, it's coming in the future. I said, and now, when you were on tonight, my mind was spinning. I should copy this book and send it to you. I didn't publish it because I'm an ecologist, and I think on the scientific level, that in 1947, when we found the crash out in the desert from the extraterrestrials, the silver paper that they found that you could crumble up and open up, that was all on the atomic level. That the atoms would realign themselves and the paper would open again.
That's a pretty good point, Ronnie. We don't know whether that's science fiction or science fact, Sir Charles. But the fact of the matter is, what she just described—that aluminum that could be crumpled and then would return to its regular form—that sounds like a nanotechnological application to me.
Well, yes, it does. You know, we can think of a lot of materials that would repair themselves that could be made with nanotechnology. And we're actually seeing some early applications in things like bridge parts. You know, they're thinking about putting materials that are smart enough to sense their own strain and perhaps make their own repairs. So, yeah, material that was made of nanomachinery or nanomaterials or metamaterials could very easily repair itself, and you wouldn't see any damage.
It's just hard to imagine the world we're about to enter. East of the Rockies, you're on the air with Sir Charles. Hello.
Hi, how you doing? This is Randy from Memphis.
Yes, Randy.
When you were talking about the gray goo, it really reminded me of a book I read in college called Kurt Vonnegut's Cat's Cradle and the Ice Nine. Are you familiar with that?
I am not.
I've seen it.
Sir Charles. Okay.
Yes. Yes, I've seen it. Ice Nine was a very interesting concept where a form of ice was found that when it froze, it became more dense than water and sank to the bottom. And it was a catalytic process that eventually made all the ice on Earth that way and froze the world over.
Oh, really?
Well, it's an interesting concept.
It just seems to me, Sir Charles, that we've got to advance significantly socially in our behavior before we can allow this kind of technology out, but it's not working out that way, is it?
Well, there's going to have to be some sort of fundamental change in human nature before we can really have this sort of technology in a general sense without killing ourselves.
A number of scientists, very bright minds that I've had on the air here, have said that we had darn well better begin to colonize other planets because, reflecting on exactly that, our social progress or lack of it, we're going to need another planet because we're going to ruin this one. And it seems to me nanotechnology has the potential to do exactly that.
Well, I think that we could also undo any damage eventually. I mean, it would not be a very pleasant thing. My personal feeling is when we reach the technical level to be able to do it, the Earth should be a park. We should live elsewhere.
All right, West of the Rockies, you're on the air with Sir Charles. Hi.
Hello?
Hello.
Art.
Yes.
A pleasure talking to you. Sir Charles.
Yes.
What is your background?
Well, basically, I've done most of my work in aerospace and defense years ago, and then in the last few years, most of my background has been in research in artificial intelligence and robotics.
Okay.
I have a strong background in electronics and very deeply into physics.
Okay. Well, we have mutual experience in aerospace. I have 13 years with the U.S. military. And then I switched to bioengineering. I hold a Ph.D., and I've been in the patent office for the last 20 years. And my research told me, you know, that if I can eliminate paralysis before it starts at the onset of an injury, and which I'm quite certain I can, I believe in patent suppression, you know. I think you're a very bright man, but I don't think you're going to see this technology in our lifetime because of what I just said, you know.
All right. Well, it's a good question, Sir Charles. Are we going to see how much of this is the average person likely to see manifest in their lifetime?
Well, that's an excellent question, and I'll tell you why. A number of years ago, some research in paralysis and repairing damage to the spinal cord was done, and what they found was actually quite simple. Most of the damage that was done in spinal injuries could be halted or reversed by the application of two compounds, oxytocin and vasopressin, using hyperbaric oxygen or oxygen under high pressure, and a lot of the materials would diffuse into the injury site and help to reverse or halt the damage. With the application of something called nerve growth factor, many of the neurons would reconnect. And so with a minimal amount of rehabilitation, people would be back on their feet again. They actually severed and reconnected the spinal cords of rats in some of the experiments. But this was like 10 years ago, and we've seen nothing more, heard nothing more about it. So there has definitely been a great deal of advancement in spinal injuries and how to repair them, yet we don't really hear anything about it. So it does make you wonder, what advances have been made since, and why are we not hearing about it?
Well, okay, answer that one.
I think it's got to do with the control of information, and it all comes down to who's funding the research and who's going to make the money on it.
Uh-huh. Well, I just don't see how this science can proceed if, in the end, people cannot make money on it. That man said he worked in the patent office. I think we're beginning to get to the point where, for example, if somebody were to put together something that would, it doesn't matter, allow the space elevator to be reality now, and they applied for a patent on it, or something that would... any of the other applications that we're talking about and send it to the patent office, the patent office wouldn't begin to know how to either award or not award the patent because they would not understand what was right in front of them.
Well, I've been through a couple of patent application processes where they either disallowed or didn't understand the technology, and a great deal of money went down the hole and we never heard it hit bottom. So I have a sort of a bad taste in my mouth over the patent issue.
Yeah, but there's got to be a way, in the end, it sounds wonderful that the world will become some sort of utopian place where everything is free and you ask for whatever you want, food or furniture or housing, and it just appears. But, if somebody can't make money on it, it probably isn't going to happen, or is it?
Well, consider that money is actually a tool of civilization, not of individuals. If we have the ability to provide everything for ourselves as individuals, then the only issue we have in terms of civilization is entertainment and communication, relating experiences to each other. Money is the thing that makes our economy possible, but it also makes cooperation of huge amounts of people possible on big projects like getting to the moon or developing cancer vaccines. Once we reach the nanotech stage and everybody basically has everything they need out of a replicator box, I don't see how society as we know it is going to hold together, because we certainly won't have the exchange of money that we have.
And without that, you don't have an economy. First-time caller line, you're on the air with Sir Charles. Hello.
Hello, Art. Hello, Sir Charles. How are you doing today?
Good.
My name is John. I'm calling from the Gulf Coast. Sir Charles, my question is this. Once we create this box, transport box that you were discussing, and then we have these wonderful batteries, and we have the massive amounts of solar energy that goes into these batteries, wouldn't we actually be living almost in a utopian society where people are free to discuss their minds and basically just improving everybody?
Well, yes, we would have a utopian society, but understand that utopia doesn't come from having things. It comes from a state of mind. People achieve happiness by the achievement of goals, not from the acquisition of things. So no matter if everybody has everything they want, you really have to undergo adversity to understand the other man's position and how tough life can be. And you have to have problems in your life in order to understand how good things can be.
Well, but yes, but given, doesn't this technology remove the adversity that you
well,
just
yes, it
about?
Does, and that's a real concern. You see, the people who you know who are truly of character are those who have been through very tough times.
Right.
And people who have had no adversities and have everything handed to them tend to be very bland individuals.
That's
I
right.
think that is one of our greatest dangers, the loss of humanity itself because of a loss of civilization, when everything is given to you for free.
Well, that's right. You're exactly right. And it brings to mind the bumper I play from time to time in the year 2525, when our arms are hanging loosely by our sides, and we've got nothing to do because it's all done for us, or at the wish or whim, anybody gets whatever they want. It's just unimaginable, Sir Charles, and yet it's in front of us.
Yes, it is.
So you don't have so many answers for the social aspect of this, do you?
You know, I think that we may have to end up with a stratified society where individuals start at the bottom and undergo hardships and then graduate to a higher level where more becomes available for them, and the qualities of mind can emerge. I don't see any easy way for it. It'll be just like a childhood. Consider if you have a 1,000-year or longer lifespan, how are you going to have to work your way up through the ranks before you can be respected for your mind, because unless you develop and display the ability to use your mind and to reason and interact with others in a reasonable manner, you're not truly a human being anyway.
Well, then, wouldn't that really mean that you would have to, in some way, not be in receipt of this technology right away, but in some manner have to earn the right to use it?
I think that's true. One thing that many people very conveniently forget is that freedom isn't free. Everything has a cost.
Right.
And everything that you do, you must earn. You must work for in some manner.
Yeah, that's exactly right. First, Wildcard Line, you're on the air with Sir Charles. Hi.
Hello, my name is James. I'm from Salinas, California.
Okay.
And I have a question about nanotubes. I've always wondered, is it possible to wrap a nanotube around, say, a piece of iron or ferric oxide?
Well, nanotubes themselves are very, very tiny. They're, you know, thousands of times smaller than a human hair. And while you probably could wrap it around it, it wouldn't really do much for you. You'd have a tiny fiber around it, and it would probably break fairly easily, because even though it has a very high tensile strength, it's only in the bulk that we see the strength of materials emerge in a useful manner. A tiny little fiber like that would be like wrapping a hair around the Brooklyn Bridge. You really wouldn't see any advantage to it.
Yeah. My application really doesn't have to do with strength, though. It would be more along the lines of a superconducting magnet, whereas you could polarize the iron within the tube and then gather the tubes in alignment and maybe apply an electric field to everything, and it would create a superconducting magnet that would operate at room temperature.
Well, and again, you know, when the conduction properties of nanotubes are better understood and we have true superconductors at room temperature and above, yes, we'll see some very interesting advances in magnetics. Absolutely, we will.
We certainly would. How close are we to nanotubes that would allow superconducting at room temperature? Have they actually experimented with this? Have they done it?
Well, they're getting fairly close. They haven't, to my mind, done any cryogenic experiments with nanotubes, which would give you some means of qualifying how well they were performing. But estimates are that room temperature conduction in nanotubes could reach over 1,000 amps per square centimeter, which is very, very favorable. And we could eventually end up replacing a lot of power lines with this stuff. I think that it's going to be probably 5 or 6 more years of development of the metamaterials phase before we see real, true room temperature superconductors.
And there's also going to have to be, at least in the beginning, a gigantic manufacturing process underway to do this, right?
Well, yes. Right now, the material is processed in huge ovens, and special chemicals and pressures and temperatures are used. So right now, it's a factory job, yes.
Got it. All right, Sir Charles, hold on. We're at the top of yet another hour taking questions for Sir Charles on probably one of the wildest things you've ever heard in your whole life. It's called nanotechnology. From Manila in the Philippines, where the rain falls and falls and falls, I'm Art Bell.